Welcome to episode 44. We'll go with it. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Henry Price, and I am joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how are you this morning?
I'm great. Ready to go. Glad everybody's with us this morning or this evening or whenever you're listening.
Let's just jump into this, which is our custom. Where we leave off last time we did this?
Well, we left in sort of the end of chapter 32 of Genesis. Most of our time in that chapter was with these last 10 verses, which is the story of Jacob wrestling with a stranger on the banks of the Jabbok River. And a lot of good stuff there. A lot of really good insights into the way that God deals with us, the way that he lets us win. He loses so that we might win, and we connected that to the ultimate loss of God and in his willing sacrificial death for us. And in that loss, we gained eternal life. So embedded in this story is the story of Good Friday as well. And there's toward the end of this chapter, and it's sort of a segue to chapter 33, Jacob names this place Peniel, which is from the Hebrew about the face of God. And he says, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." So Jacob realizes that here he is on the threshold of his return from exile. He's about to meet his brother, which is what we're going to get to in just a minute. And he encounters God in this threshold moment of his life. He sees God face to face. He encounters the God who fights with him, who wrestles with him, and over whom Jacob prevails, thanks to the grace of God. And so this moment in Jacob's life is one of those pivotal moments that all of us have in our lives at one time or another. God arranges this so that it's perfect timing, because Jacob is returning with guilt. He's returning with fear. He's returning with anxiety about what's about to happen. And what God gives to Jacob during this time of wrestling is a name change. He's no longer Jacob. He's not Israel. And Israel means he who strives with God, because Jacob has striven with God and with men and has prevailed. So Jacob is going to emerge from this with a new name, a new and a deeper understanding of the God in whom he believes. And as we'll see in chapter 33, he's going to enter into the promised land, into this meeting with his brother, also with a renewed confidence and hope. And even, amazingly for Jacob, with a new sense in which he's not the center of the universe. Because as we'll see in just a minute, Jacob, perhaps for the first time in his life, actually puts the concerns of himself behind those of others. So this really is a time of change for Jacob. Maybe not complete change, but at least it's what God uses in order to prepare him for what's about to happen, which is reconciliation with his brother Esau. And one interesting note, which I don't remember if we got to last time or not, is the way that Jacob leaves this encounter with God, because he leaves limping, because the angel God disguised as a man, he touched Jacob's hip. And so when Jacob walks away from this, he's limping. He leaves this encounter with God wounded, if you will. But it's a blessed wound, because it's a wound that reminds him of the encounter that he just had with the God of grace. So that takes us to the end of 32. And here at 33 is when the scene shifts from an encounter that Jacob has with God to an encounter that he's about to have with his brother Esau. And we have to keep in mind that these chapter divisions we have in our Bibles were added a lot later. So if you were reading in the original, you would go right from this verse that talks about the sons of Israel not eating the sinew on the hip because of this encounter that Jacob had and his wound in his hip. It goes right from that to these words. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So we go right from what just happened between Jacob and God. We know that the sun is just coming up. Dawn has just broken. And Jacob lifts up his eyes and he sees Esau. Now, it's been a long time since he's seen Esau. 20 years. Two decades have passed since they last parted. And as you remember from earlier in chapter 33, Jacob had received word that his brother was coming with 400 men, which was a militia size back then. So Jacob assumes the worst. He thinks that his brother's on the war path. You know, he's had 20 years for his revenge, his dessert revenge to cool, if you will. And he's ready to serve it. At least that's what Jacob thinks. But what Jacob does is different. Earlier, he had sent all these people ahead of him. He had divided up his family, and he thought, well, if Esau attacks one half of my family, at least the other half will get free. And he had sent everybody ahead of him, and Jacob lingers behind. So it's like he creates this massive human shield between him and his brother. But when we get to this point in the story, this is what I was talking about earlier, things change. He does divide up his family. He divides his children among the various mothers between Leah and Rachel and the two concubines. And he puts each mother with her children, and he lines them up. He's got the maidservants first with their kids, and then he has Leah with hers, and then at the very end he has Rachel with Joseph. Benjamin has not been born yet. So Rachel and Joseph are the very last ones. And it's like as the story is told, we're expecting, based upon what we know of Jacob, we're expecting Jacob then to be the last one. And here's where the surprise comes. Because verse 3 says that Jacob himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. So instead of hanging at the back like he had been, Jacob now moves in front of everybody, in front of his wives, in front of his children, and he puts himself out front. He puts himself in danger because he doesn't know what's about to happen. And he bows down to his brother 7 times as his brother approaches. So, you know, for all of Jacob's faults and the faults that we have that we see in him, here he's doing the right thing. He's the one that Esau has the issue with, or had the issue with. And so he puts himself in front of everyone else in danger, in possible danger anyway. And then he goes out to meet his brother, and he meets his brother, interestingly, and I think wisely. He meets him humbly, with deference, and waiting to see what will take place.
Yeah, I think it's you can get a good visual of him lining up his family like that, and then like him going out in front, but not just walking out. I think that, you know, you can have like this, like, okay, and this is where Jacob really comes into his own. So he straightens up his back and walks out in front. But that's not at all what happened. Like, he limps out in front.
He's limping out. Yeah. 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 He returns. He's wounded. He's just fought with God. And what better time to be reconciled to your brother?
Yeah. 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 Chapter divisions, man. That's a whole other thing. I know you said that like a little while ago now, but chapter divisions bother me.
Yeah, you know, I think you're the one that told me about this. They do make a Bible. I think Elise Fitzpatrick has mentioned this too before, that they've printed a Bible that has all chapter and verse divisions removed. Is that right?
Yeah. I have one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's got to be a whole different reading experience.
It is. It's a whole different thing. I mean, I was doing a men's Bible study, and in Ecclesiastes, man, I can't remember the chapter. Anyway, right in the middle of one of the chapters, you know, Solomon says, you know, eat your food, drink your wine. God has already approved what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some more stuff after that. And I was like, but when we read that, I just interrupted everyone. And I was like, that's the end of the chapter. He just dropped the mic and like walked off
chopped the mic, walked off the stage.
Like, that's, I can't believe that's not the end of the book. Like,
right.
God is like, what you do. Boof. Like, that's it. Yeah. Little feedback. Like, so like, that's it.
Yeah, I like to remind people that, you know, by the time you hold a Bible in your hand, you are already holding an interpreted document. I mean, you've got the chapter and verse divisions, which I think influence our interpretation way more than we realize. And you've got, in most Bibles anyway, you've got some kind of description at the head of each chapter. You know, I'm looking at my Bible right now, and chapter 34 is called the Defilement of Dinah. And chapter 33, Jacob makes peace with Esau. Chapter 32, Jacob fights with the angel. Well, all of these are partly true, but they're far from the whole truth. It's kind of like the parables, you know. The parables, by naming the parables, we have done a greater disservice than we could ever imagine. So by titles, they affect our interpretation.
You're already letting somebody tell you what this is about.
Yes, exactly. There's interpretation that is built in to the Bibles that we have. And then if you have a study Bible of some sort, then it's just, of course, you know, compounded after that. But, and even, honestly, even the names of the biblical books, you know, Numbers, for instance. Who wants to read a book called Numbers? And who knows what Deuteronomy means? These chapter divisions can really, really throw us off.
I every time I pick up a study Bible, I'm like disappointed.
Yeah, I don't use them.
I mean, I have like a bunch of study Bibles, and I reference them every once in a while just to see like what they say about something. I'm usually like pretty disappointed. I usually am too.
Usually
like, man, that's weak sauce.
Yeah, I teach a Bible class in my church on Sunday mornings, and on occasion someone will read a commentary out of their study Bible, and 9 times out of 10 I either find it wanting or completely disagree with it. just the way it goes.
It's the way it goes. All right, so back to this thing, though. That was a nice little bunny trail. Sorry, guys, to disparage your Bibles for you. But so Jacob bows down 7 times. Got to be some biblical significance in the 7 there, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is this 7 is certainly the biblical number for completeness, for wholeness. So he is completely, utterly placing himself at the mercy of his brother, and he's completely and utterly doing so with humility and deference, and you might even say repentance because of what he's done in the past. Now, the great irony here about this is that when Jacob stole the birthright, the blessing of the firstborn from Esau, his father, Isaac, gave him this blessing. He said, your brothers will bow down to you. So the blessing that Isaac gave is seen completely opposite here, because instead of Jacob's brothers bowing down to him, he is bowing down to his brothers, to his brother Esau. So there's some pretty heavy irony going on in Jacob's actions, but he's doing the right thing. He's the one that deceived his father, stole from his brother, ran away, and has spent 20 years in exile. So as he comes home, he needs to be the one who's bowing down to Esau. Now, I'm not I'm not saying that Jacob has completely pure and godly motives here, because none of us do. I never do anything from completely pure motives. None of us do, because we carry the old Adam around our neck. But, you know, so maybe Jacob certainly is concerned for his life, and so he wants to present himself to Esau, who has 400 men with him, bear in mind. He wants to present himself in such a way that he is going to appear even visually to his brother as one who comes not for a fight, but for a reconciliation. So this is the end of verse 3. And at this point, if we didn't know the story, I mean, if we knew nothing about what was about to happen, then we would be waiting with bated breath to see what Esau does. And that is one of the, I guess it's one of the handicaps of knowing the biblical story, is sometimes these surprises in the narrative are missed by us, because we're like, oh yeah, yeah, I remember what happened. And so when we hear it, it no longer has that shock that it would have the very first time that we were hearing or reading this story. Because for the last 20 years, we know nothing about Esau. You know, we don't know if he sat at home and he daydreamed every day for the last two decades about getting a pound of flesh from his brother. All we know is that he shows up with 400 men. That's all we know. So when Jacob goes out to him and he bows down to the ground seven times as he draws near to his brother, is Esau going to just stare at him and, you know, give him this killer look? Is he going to chastise him? Is he going to get off his horse and walk over with a sword and chop his head off? I mean, what's he going to do? And so, because we have this uncertainty, and because the last thing we heard about Esau was him wanting to kill Jacob, then we should be utterly shocked by what happens next. It's completely, completely unexpected. Because as Jacob draws near to his brother, here's what Esau does. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. I mean, if that's got to be one of the most shocking turn of events that the scriptures have. Because everything, I mean, there was never in the relationship between these two brothers prior to this, there was never, at least recorded for us, any display of affection. It was nothing but animosity. There was ill will on the part of Jacob, like he felt cheated his whole life, and so he himself turned into a cheater. I mean, even in the womb, they're fighting. Even in the womb, they're wrestling with each other. And when they're born, you know, Jacob's got his hand on Esau's heel, trying to yank him back into the womb so that he can pull ahead of him. You have the whole incident that involved the lentil soup. Then, of course, you have the huge debacle with the stealing of the blessing of the firstborn. So up until this point, there has been nothing but negativity and hostility between these two brothers. And so for Esau, who is the wronged brother in this story, for him to do what he does is remarkable. And there's like this heaping up of these verbs and these images. He runs to meet him. He embraces him. He falls on his neck. He kisses him. And then the pronoun changes. And they wept. So it wasn't just Esau, but it was both of them who wept together as they're finally reconciled with each other.
Yeah, that's a pretty awesome picture.
Yeah, it's really amazing what wounds God is able to heal. You know, no matter this is pretty serious stuff. You know, these guys are brothers, and it's one thing to be mad at somebody or even to want revenge against somebody. It's something else to want to kill him. Right. And Esau did. He wanted to kill him. So for this complete change to take place it's a remarkable testimony to the ability of God to take two people who are at serious odds with each other and to bring them together.
I think it says something about reconciliation is always in the will of God. It's not like something you got to ask the question about.
Yeah, like, does God want me to be reconciled or not?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna fast and pray, and see if it's God's will that I be reconciled to this person. It is. You just go ahead and pray about something else. But because reconciliation is always in the heart of God, it's always in the will of God. He never thinks that you and this other person hating each other, being at odds with each other, fighting with each other, being unreconciled is a good thing. He is a God of reconciliation. And so that obviously first and foremost is about us and God. But certainly horizontally that he wants that to come down and then run out to each other. And this is why St. Paul, says that, as much as it depends on you, be at peace with all people, which is a way of saying, like, as much as it depends on you, be reconciled with everybody that you can be reconciled. Now, I mean, like, you can only do so much, I mean, you sometimes it's not up to you, and that's the way it goes, Jacob might have made that move, come out, and maybe Esau would have chopped his head off, and, well, you've done all you can do at that point. Or maybe Esau's coming there to reconcile, which obviously he is, and Jacob would have screamed charge and, like, just started fighting him right there, or ran away, or who knows what, and then, their reconciliation doesn't happen. But as much as it depends on you, that's what God would have, is you being willing to reconcile with anybody. Whether you're the wrong person or the person that did the wrong or whatever it is, that's how he would have you be. It's not easy. I mean, there's some people we don't want to reconcile with. But nonetheless, I'm sure that we probably don't have people in our lives that have wronged us more than Jacob wronged Esau. I doubt there's a whole lot of those people in your life, Chad.
Yeah, I doubt that, seriously. I'm sure there have been a few people who have the thought has crossed their mind, I'd like to kill him. But hopefully that's far in the past now. You know, I was thinking when you were talking, it doesn't matter who it is that we need to be reconciled with. The one thing that is always certain is that it is two sinners who are coming together to be reconciled. You know, it's not as if, okay, I'm the holy one, the innocent one, and I'm going to be reconciled with the guilty one, because both of us are sinners. And so even if maybe the blame is almost completely with someone else, well, I still come as one who is flawed and in need of forgiveness myself. And so reconciliation involves forgiveness between brothers.
Well, every time I've seen reconciliation happen between people who, and usually there's one person who's like more in the wrong than the other or whatever. But by that point where it's animosity is going on, by that point, like, there's no way for there not to be sin on both sides. It's just not possible.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know? And so, one might have more blame than the other over, obviously Jacob has more blame than Esau over the initial event, but it certainly seems that Esau probably has things that he feels bad about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably so. I mean, it was wrong for him to desire to kill his brother and to entertain those ideas for however long he entertained them. So even though he was the wronged brother, he himself was wrong as well. And I think awareness of that fact is a stimulus toward reconciliation.
Right.
Because the more that I project complete guilt onto the party with whom I need to be reconciled, the chances of that reconciliation taking place diminish. But the more that I understand that I am a sinner, I am wrong as well, the more I realize my need to be reconciled with the other person.
Right. That's it.
Yeah. So, So that's what happens here. You know, it's a remarkable scene, and I don't know if anybody else caught this or not when they were listening to what Esau did, but I could not help but jump ahead when I heard this description of Esau to the parable of the prodigal son, which we talked about so much at the Christ Old Fast Conference, because the verbs that are used to describe the actions of the father are almost identical to what happens here too. Because in Luke 15, it says the father ran and fell on his neck and kissed his son. So you have Esau, amazingly, assuming almost a paternal action here. He's like the father who is greeting the son who's been on the run for the last 20 years, which, you know, really it matches a lot of what we've seen with Esau in the past. We talked about that when we discussed the theft of the blessing of the firstborn, how Esau is really, in some ways, a Christ figure in some of these stories, because he is the one who has the blessing taken away from him and given to someone else, just like Christ is the one who becomes a curse for us in order that we might be blessed on his account.
Dressed in his clothes.
Yeah, yeah. We're the ones who are dressed in the clothes of Esau so that we might receive the blessing of the Father. And so here, and this is really the last we hear of Esau in this chapter, until the death of their father. But here we have Esau once more being used by God in a foreshadowing sort of way to point forward to what is going to happen at the reconciliation of the world in Christ, when God reconciles us to himself in the death of his son, the son who becomes a curse, the son who becomes sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God.
Yeah, well, what Jacob did was Jacob took all Esau's stuff and went off to a far land. I mean, it's what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is kind of an Old Testament variation of the parable of the prodigal son.
Yeah, he took all his stuff and he bailed out. Now, he didn't squander it all, you know, but now they're meeting again, and yeah, it looks very, very similar to the father figure in that parable. And you have to wonder, you know, I don't know, man. Like, I mean, I have brothers, so and I have we used to, you know, we beat up on each other pretty good, but 20 years would be a long time. I know that I don't know what one of my brothers would have to do for me to have not seen them for 20 years and me not be overjoyed. And so, yeah, I think that there's, I don't think it doesn't read to me, and this is all speculation, or I don't think Esau had any intention at this point of, I don't think it was like he's going out there to kill him, then Jacob comes out and shows this display of humility and Esau changes his mind. I think that Esau probably for quite some time would have liked to have seen his brother. Didn't know where he was, or it kind of sounds like he's out looking for him.
Yeah, it does. It does.
And not to kill him, like just looking for him.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't see any indication whatsoever in the way the story is told. In fact, that he's out for blood and changes his mind. In fact, it seems like he's really confused, you know, because as the story goes on, he says, you know, what's all this stuff? What are these animals that you've been sending ahead of me? I don't need this stuff. I don't need all these offerings that you've been giving to me. So it's not as if, yeah, he's moved by the sight of his brother's humility and says, all right, I'll let you live. No, he's genuinely wanting to be reconciled to his brother. And that's why he acts the way that he does, with this just really outlandish display of emotion as they're brought together. So, yeah, the brothers are reconciled finally. And at least to our knowledge, unless something happened that's not recorded, they remain so. They're together here. We're going to see them part ways in a few verses, but the next time they come back together is at the death of their father, and they bury their father together, which I think is a fitting ending to the story of these two brothers. It was their relationship with their father which led to the split between the two of them. And then you see them coming back together amicably, lovingly, burying their father years down the road.
It's probably good that this event took place, or else when it came time to bury their father, Jacob probably would have been royally freaked out.
Yeah, like, it would not have been.
We're gonna have like a double burial here. I know
it would not have been a good funeral. Yeah. I know reconciliations happen at funerals, but it's a whole lot better for it to happen before the funeral itself.
Yeah, this is like Esau's digging two graves right now. I know it.
Yeah. Right. Oh, so here's kind of the way here's how the story goes after this. Jacob, is embraced by Esau, and Esau now lifts up his eyes. Jacob lifted up his eyes earlier and saw Esau. Now Esau lifts up his eyes and he sees the women and the children, and he says, "Who are these?" And Jacob says, "The children whom God has graciously given to your servant." And so he basically introduces him to his family. You know, the maids come near, Leah comes near, Rachel comes near, and everybody's bowing down. They're showing great deference to Esau, the brother-in-law and the uncle that they're all just meeting. And keep in mind, this is a young family too. The oldest could not be more than 13, because they've been gone 20 years. He had to labor for 7 years for Leah. The oldest is just a teenager. So very young family, young children, and they're meeting their uncle. Their uncle Esau now. And then he goes on and he says, you know, what I was talking about earlier, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? You know, by all the flocks and the herds that Jacob had sent ahead to pacify his brothers. And that's what Jacob says. He says, to find favor in your sight. And Esau says, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. Now that I think is telling, because Jacob did take the blessing of the firstborn from his brother, but we see that God bless Esau despite that. He has plenty. Evidently, he's a very powerful guy by now. He has 400 men who are with him, and we'll hear about his family in a couple more chapters. But this verse I think is significant. This is verse 10. Jacob says, "No, please, if not I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand. For I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably." That verse has always struck me for more reasons than one. One is because this "I see your face as one sees the face of God." One, because I do read this story almost eschatologically, if you will, that this is kind of a picture of the final reconciliation of all God's people as we are brought together, as we appear before the face of God, and everything is finally as it should be. Here's Christ with his family presenting them before the Father, and we see the face of the one that we are reconciled with completely and eternally in the sacrifice of Christ. But also, think that we can read this a little bit differently too. I see your face as one sees the face of God, that when we are reconciled with someone else, that is a manifestation of divine mercy at work as well. That when we see the face of one with whom we were at odds, maybe the one that we have hurt, the one we've run away from, that when we are once again united with that person by the act of forgiveness, As we humbly approach them and seek to be reconciled to them, that we see in that face that forgives us and that welcomes us and that embraces us a manifestation of the face of God, and that he is veiled, if you will, in this human face, just like Esau was a display of the face of God to Jacob.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's quite a thing for Jacob to say that, considering that he did just see God.
Yeah, yeah, especially, right, especially in this context.
Yeah, I mean, like, so he is a guy that wrestled with God, and it says he says I've seen the face of God and lived. You know, I've seen God face to face, right? That's what he says. Mm-hmm. And then he turns around and tells his brother, "When I see you, I see the face of God," which is to say that Esau's forgiving and gracious reception of him is a very God-like thing. Like, this is mm-hmm. how God is. It's even, I mean, that's a nice thing if you and I say it, like, hey, you reconcile with someone, they forgive you or whatever, and you say, like, hey, that was very Christ-like move. It's a whole other thing if I say, like, it's like I'm looking at the face of God, which, by the way, I saw last night. Like,
yeah, you're right. Literally, yeah, face to face, it is. It's a whole different thing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a pretty powerful statement, man. Pretty powerful admission by Jacob there.
Yeah, I really think it. Like I said earlier, it really is a turning point for Jacob. This what happened with the name change and his encounter with God. And you know, isn't it fascinating that here he was worried about fighting Esau, but instead he ends up fighting God. And then when he encounters Esau, he encounters grace and mercy and forgiveness. So it's as if he got the fighting out of the way, and God said, "You have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." And then he meets his brother, and sure enough, God has paved the way for everything to be reconciled between him and Esau.
Yeah, man, that's awesome.
Fantastic story.
It is.
So we just have a couple minutes left. I think we can wrap up this chapter. There's not a whole lot that takes place as the narrative goes on. So Esau does receive the gift from his brother, and Esau wants Jacob to come live with him, it sounds to me like, because Esau says more or less, "Hey, let's travel together. Let's go home to Seir, which was the home of Esau, and I'll go ahead of you, and you can travel. You and your family can travel behind me." But Jacob says, "No, you would move too fast. We have flocks, we have herds, we have women with children. We can only move at a very, very slow pace because of the size of the company. So you go on ahead, and we will join you." But ironically, he doesn't. And at least if he does, we're not told that takes place. So Esau returns that day back home. And then Jacob, instead of going on to where Esau is, he journeys to a place called Sukkot, which means booths. So Jacob goes to a different spot. And the narrative sort of sets us up for what we're going to encounter in the next chapter, because it says that they came to a place later that was called Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. And he buys a piece of land there from Hamor, who is the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver. And he builds an altar, and he names the altar Elohe Israel. Now, the reason this is significant is because what's going to happen in the next chapter that has to do with the city of Shechem and Shechem himself, who falls in love with Jacob's daughter, Dinah, and ends up raping her, which will be the whole subject to chapter 34, which is a negative note to end on, but that kind of sets us up for what's coming in the next 40 minutes.
Yeah, that is a negative. Go be reconciled one to another. How about that? That's
better. There you go.
Go be the face of God to someone. How about that?
That's good. Yeah. That's a way to end
there
it.
There you go. All right. Well, guys, thanks for joining us this week. You can go over to ChristHoldFast.org if you want to support this program or any of the other stuff we do. You can go over to the site, go to support, and you can make a donation there, one-time donation or a reoccurring donation. That would really help us out and be able to help us be able to continue doing this stuff. Thank you so much for those of you who have done that. And we will see you next week.